Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. It's raining outside. There are thunderstorms, but we're going to bring a little sunshine in your life, I hope, today. And we're going to talk to the author of a really great novel, The Organ Broker, Stu Strumwasser. Did I say that right, I hope?
And you said it very well. Thank you.
This is great. This is the reading teacher in me. What can I say? This book is really unique and fantastic, and we're going to talk about a young man by the name of Jack Trainor who enters the criminal world selling coke when he needed money to pay his way through college, interesting way, and he got into illegal black market for organs, which I find is really interesting topic. And when this book was sent to Book Pleasures, actually, for review, you have to pray that, you know, you're the one that they give it to, because Norm doesn't give it to everyone, and I was lucky I got this one. He said, it's all yours. I go, good, finally. So why did you decide to focus on this topic, and what research did you do in order to prepare for the novel?
Well, thanks for that great introduction and for having me today. And
you're welcome.
So to answer your first question, you know, I'm constantly asked two questions about this book. The first is, how did you get interested in this subject? And the second is, so how do you know so much about this stuff? You know, where the implication is that I was a black market organ broker. So let me just clarify and explain to your listeners that that was not the case.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't actually a black market organ, you know, dealer. And actually, how did I exactly get interested in this topic? It's funny because I don't really quite know, but it was just one of those things back in the 80s and 90s that I always thought was fascinating. Until anti-rejection drugs were invented in the early 80s, organ transplantation was rare and really difficult, and then it suddenly became extremely reasonable and possible. And so the incidence of organ transplantation just skyrocketed very quickly. I thought it was interesting. You know, it was just a subject that was of interest to me. And I'm a writer. And for a long time, this was just one of a dozen different stories that was on my mind that I thought I might someday want to write about. And what was of interest to me, Fran, was less the black market than it was the guy. And as you just said, you know, he sold coke to pay his way through college. Interesting way to pay your tuition bill. I just always thought it was fascinating because I can understand why some guy in a poor neighborhood in India or Thailand becomes the guy who finds people to sell kidneys and gets a commission. But I always thought it was incredible when I read these stories about the guys in the United States or in Israel or in Europe. Like, who grows up and says, when I get out of college, you know, and someday when I get older, I want to be a black market organ salesman? And I just thought, you know, the circumstances that led this guy to that could be so fascinating. And, like, the moral dilemmas and choices for him, you know, are just very literary. So it was always on my mind. I know this is a long answer to your question.
That's
okay. It was always on my mind. Okay. It was always on my mind. And then the story is that in March of 2008, I'm on the beach in Costa Rica at one of my best friend's wedding. And I don't know why, but at 2 in the morning with a couple of drinks in me, I kind of realized the format in which this story could be told really effectively. And as you know from having read the book, it really is a 300-page letter that Jack has written to someone. And that idea hit me, and having intentionally not taken my laptop to Costa Rica so I could take a break for a few days, I didn't have a computer. I literally started handwriting the first page of the book on the back of the hotel menu. And when I got back to New York, when I got back to New York, I started writing the book, and then I realized I better do some research and learn about this stuff.
That is great. Can you hear me?
I can, yes.
Hello? Oh, okay.
Yes, can
you? You know what? My cell phone rang at the same time, and I was trying not to hear it. Okay. So you created your storyline on the back of a man. That is really cool. Why are so many people desperate for organs, and why are they so expensive?
Yeah, great question. So the organ shortage crisis, which kind of creates the backdrop for my story, and which has also become an issue of great, you know, personal concern for me, is a function of, it's a chain of events that works like this. America overeats. We've got a huge problem with obesity. Obesity often leads to diabetes. The incidence of diabetes in this country is terrifying. I mean, it's a problem that's talked about, but it could literally be one of the biggest economic and health problems facing our country. 5 years
that
ago...
That is so true.
Yeah, 5 years ago, 8.3% of Americans were classified as diabetic. 5 years later, in 2015, not only are there 5 million more people that are now diabetic, but the penetration of the population has gone from 8.3% to 10%. One out of every 10 Americans is diabetic. And so what happens is obesity and diabetes often leads to problems with your kidneys. Renal failure, end-stage renal disease is the final step in that chain. And those people then need a kidney transplant to remain healthy. While they wait, they go on a list, you know, some of them, waiting for a transplant, and that list has exploded. That list, which, you know, was first formed in the 80s. When I started writing my book in 2008, it was around 90,000 names. Just 7 years later, it has ballooned in just the last 7 years from 90,000 to 124,000. About 80% of those people need kidneys. If you don't get one, you go on dialysis, and the average wait is about 7 years. And dialysis all sorts of And dialysis does all sorts of other tough things to your body that make you sicker and sicker. And so some of those people, a very small portion, they find out that rather than waiting 7 years, they could buy one on the black market, and the cost is about $150,000.
And will those people can afford that? My God, that's like your whole life savings sometimes. But it's worth your health.
There's a lot of people who could never afford that. For some people, that might be a life savings. You know, there's a lot of people in America for whom that's not even that big an amount of money. Someone who's got a few million bucks in the bank who ends up in end-stage renal disease, if you were faced with that choice, buy a kidney from a guy in South Africa and then live another 30 years, or go on dialysis and get sicker and sicker and die, what would you do?
I agree. And yet they have all these places that, well, I just read a book last year that was called Kill a Nurse, which scared the daylights out of me and said, God forbid I ever had to go on that. I would be afraid just to walk into one of those places where it was a true story about the DeVia Center in Waco, in Texas, where the nurse that was there, she wanted to, she killed patients because they didn't give her the medical part, the drug part. They made her take care of the patients. Frightening. It's frightening to think that that could really happen.
She intentionally killed them?
Yep, she intentionally killed them, yeah. Because she wanted, she did something with the water and the bleach that they use. I read this book and I cried. I was shivered because people were standing there and realized, nobody said anything until finally three patients spoke up and they finally listened to them, and a lot of people died because of it. And she couldn't imagine why she got arrested and is in jail. She thinks she's innocent. So let's talk about Jack Traynor. Tell us about Jack, and who is Dr. Wolf, and how did he come in contact with him? How exactly did he get involved with this mess?
Right. You asked these great questions with multiple parts.
I sat there and went through the review, then I went through the book again, and I'm going, like, I could ask a million questions.
No, it's
rather
great.
Than
Listen.
What's the book about, because you can't, you know, you want to focus on what the author is really saying, not what's the book about. Everybody knows what the book is about.
Right. Well, I don't think it's hard to get an author to talk about his own novel. Mm-hmm. And it's fun for me to, you know, think about and explore the character. So Jack was just a guy, and he grew up in a dysfunctional family, and he had a kind of abusive father. And at some point along the way, he kind of accidentally got into selling drugs in the 80s, and he liked it. He liked the power and the money and the ability to tell his father to go to hell, which he subsequently did. And he paid his way through NYU, and then he paid his way through NYU Law School with a plan to go straight and be an attorney and lead a normal life. But one thing led to another, and he got introduced to a friend who needed a kidney and somehow got seduced into playing a role in helping him find the kidney from some drug dealers that he knew. He realized this is a huge market opportunity, and he can make a lot of money. He started kind of exploring that and going down that path. So what Jack Traynor does in the book, the kind of anti-hero of the organ broker, back in the early 90s, mid-90s, he runs around the world meeting with transplant centers and doctors in third world countries, in places like Brazil and South Africa, where some of them were willing to take a payoff to source the kidney and to do these procedures. And this is based on, you know, very real circumstances that exist in the world today. There is a global black market for organs. There are transplant centers and doctors that are on the take, and it's now estimated to be well in excess of a $1 billion business. And, you know, the fictional character Jack Traynor is based on some of the transplant tourism directors who do exist in real life in the United States and Europe.
That's amazing. And it's scary. So someone, a regular person, that's in renal failure, that would need his services, how do they move to the top of the list to get a kidney, as opposed to somebody that does not move to the top of the list? And what's the criteria for giving the person the kidney, the money or more?
Well, do you mean legally or in the black market?
I don't care.
Okay. So
black market, probably the money. Legally, what is it?
Right. Right. So, of course, you're right. In the black market, it's just about the money. Legally, the problem is that the system is terrible. And I've come to be, the more that I learned about this problem and about the organ shortage crisis in America, the more concerned I became. And I just couldn't help but feel like, you know, I can't fix this and I can't, you know, save these people, but maybe I could do a tiny bit to help. And I want to point out to your listeners that they should please, if they're not signed up to be an organ donor, please do. It takes a few seconds, and all you have to do is just go to www.donatelife.net, and you can register to be an organ donor. It's one tiny little thing you can do. It'll probably never matter, but someday you might end up saving 8 other people's lives. And now, Fran, I literally forgot your question. I'm sorry. Oh, how do you move up the list?
How do you move up the list? I mean, in hospitals, do they follow the same protocol? Is it who you are, who
you
know?
Well, they don't. So here's the deal. There is the Department of Health and Human Services has a division called HRSA, which oversees the National Organ Transplantation Act, which was passed in the 80s. And that act, that law, established that HRSA should assign a contract to someone who's not a government agency, but who will oversee the list and help try to facilitate and create access to organs for those who need them. A nonprofit organization was formed in the 80s called UNOS, the United Network for Organ Sharing. They have received that contract for 30 years now, and as far as I know, no one else has ever had it, and I don't think personally that they're doing the greatest job. when I say that, it's sometimes controversial, but as I've said, the list has just gone crazy, and I don't see it slowing down. When I started writing my book, it was 90,000 names, and the wait was 4 or 5 years for a kidney. 7 years later, it's 124,000 names, and it's a 7-year wait. Where will we be in 10 years? Unless something very fundamental shifts, we have an enormous problem for the health of our people in the United States, but also it's an enormous economic problem because this country now spends over $10 billion a year paying for dialysis for people we couldn't find kidneys for, because 85% of the expense of dialysis is paid for by Medicare, which means you and me, our taxes. So the list, and this was, I guess, the focus of your question, there is no real national registry. Each state has a list. Each OPO, the hospitals that procure organs for people who need them, has its own list, and they even have what's called colloquially a God committee, which is a committee of people at the hospital who decide when to make exceptions and move someone up or down the list. And
how would they get to be moved up and down the list? By who they know, the doctor likes them, or just favoritism?
Well, this is the problem. So,
what,
there
donations
should be
to the hospital?
Well, that would be unethical, right? But here's the problem.
Yeah, I know. I didn't say it was ethical.
The research shows that rich people get organs more than poor people, that white people get them more than black people, and it's just horrible.
Right.
Yeah, the research on these statistics is atrocious. There should be national standards. That you shouldn't have the ability to, you know, manipulate the list that way. They all deny that that's the case, that that would never happen. And yet when you look at the total numbers, you see, like I said, rich people get organs more than poor people, white people more per capita than black people. People often tell me that there isn't really a black market for organs, that this is all fantasy. And yet, all you have to do is look at the amount of anti-rejection drugs sold in the United States by Big Pharma, and if you matched it up to the number of people who got an organ legally, you'd see, well, they're selling twice as much of those drugs as we would need for the people who got an organ legally, so where's the rest of it going? These people go to South Africa or to Brazil, they get a kidney, they come back to the United States, nobody questions them, they just start, you know, giving them the drugs they need. And, you know, the system is completely out of whack. And what upsets me and concerns me is 21 people are going to die today because an organ wasn't donated in time. 18 of those were people who needed kidneys, which is a redundant organ. We've got two of them, you know, and this problem actually could be fixed. And I feel like while Congress sits around arguing over who gets to be in charge and does very little to actually help the country in terms of doing any work and passing laws, this is one of these places where it should be the easiest thing in the world for conservatives and liberals to agree. Because usually when you have a political or a social problem, the thing is you say, okay, we want to do a thing to help people. In this case, you know, get organs, access to organs and help their health, right? But the problem is it's going to cost money. So who's going to pay for that, right? And that's where the conflict arises. In this case, for every kidney we get that prevents someone from going on dialysis, U.S. taxpayers save about $250,000. So, I mean, if ever there was a problem, an issue, where Republicans and Democrats should be able to agree, you save people's lives, and if you do that, you end up saving money. It really shouldn't be that hard.
It shouldn't, but they can never agree on it, just, you know, the postage stamp or anything like that. So why would they agree on anything else? Dialysis is dangerous. I know it's bad. And people, once they're on it, they're stuck on it for life. That's what's really scary. So sometimes families are able to donate kidneys and organs if they match, if they get lucky. If you get somebody. So what was Jack's rationale for doing this besides the fact that he needed money for college?
Well, he sold drugs because he needed money for college. He sold organs.
Well, a lot of people do that, unfortunately.
Yeah, he sold organs because he needed money for other things. And I think that you got to read the book.
You're not going
to
tell him why.
Yeah, to understand that, I would say, you know, it became his profession and he needed to, you know, pay his bills like the rest of us. But also I think for Jack, it became very connected to his self-worth. He felt powerful and validated by the fact that he could make so much money, he made millions doing this, and also that every time he did, he was personally responsible for saving a life. And like a few of the people that I've talked to in this business, they rationalize what they're doing by, you know, kind of arguing that they're doing something good, when in fact the black market does tremendous bad, you know, around the world.
I get it.
And hurts, you know, poor people in a variety of countries. But they don't, you know, Jack doesn't see it that way.
No, not at, well, he doesn't. Well, who are the other people that are involved with him in this? I don't want to give away too much about the characters.
Well, I guess, you know, his antagonist in the book is a guy named Wallace, who he's the guy who sources the people, the buyers. He's a buyer's agent who sources buyers in the United States and Europe who need an organ and who are wealthy and who can afford it. And he, you know, meets Jack over the internet in the late 90s, and then more and more they start partnering on deals because Jack has built this network of hospitals and doctors around the world where he can get the organs, and Wallace has the people who need them. And by the way, if I can give a quick, you know, commercial for the book, if, you know, we haven't even told your audience, it's called The Organ Broker, and you can buy it on Amazon. The ebook is on sale, and you can also learn a little bit more about the novel and the issues that we're talking about at my website, which is theorganbroker.com.
Well, we have a listener. This is really great. And we have a whole bunch of people on Facebook that are saying hi.
great.
So who is Philip, and why does Jack want to save his life?
Wow. Okay, so...
You know, any question that I ask that you feel you don't want to answer, you know, spoiler alert, then we're not going to answer.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Okay, cool. So Philip is the name of a patient on who the entire, you know, arc of the story sort of turns. It turns out that Jack meets two people, a young man named Mark and a woman named Michelle, who he builds relationships with and feels love for the first time in 20 years. And this happens at the exact same time that he has a client die, and it somehow affected him in a way that was different than previous ones, perhaps because maybe his heart was opened a little by the fact that he had these people in his life and had relationships and a normal life for the first time in so long. And it makes him feel differently. And Jack goes through this crisis of conscience where he realizes the enormity of the bad things that he's done and starts to feel like he wants to make amends. Philip is someone that he meets through Mark who needs an organ. And the issue in the book is that Wallace, his sometime partner, comes to him, and usually they broker kidneys, maybe occasionally a liver or some other organ. But, you know, everybody has two kidneys, and the liver regenerates. You can actually donate one-third of your liver to someone else, and 5 years later you're both fine. I don't know about fine, but you could both have a healthy, functioning organ. The problem and the, you know, the real plot twist occurs when Wallace comes to Jack and tells him that he's been hired by someone who wants to pay them $5 million to get a heart. And obviously the only way to get a healthy heart from someone would be to commit a crime, yeah.
Well, that's where some people might cross the line, and that's where others might consider it an option. But we're not going to say what they consider it. Yeah, that's a tough one. And that's where Jack and Wallace, well, whatever happened. Okay, so we're going to ask some other general questions so that we don't give away any more information. For those of you that are want to know more about organ donations and organ broker and why anyone would get into it, you need to read the book because it's really very interesting. And I have this habit of, you know, sitting down and reading a book in like an hour and a half, not even, And this one definitely gave me eye strain because it was that good, which is a compliment. So when creating this plot, how did you just create the storyline to capture and keep reader interest? How did you know just, you know, how to pace it? Because it was not too long and it wasn't too short. It was just the right length.
Wow, that's a great question too, Fran. It's interesting because this is the first thriller that I've written. It's also my first published book. I guess I should clarify that. I studied writing at Cornell 20 years ago, and I wrote a book that I'm proud of that was shopped in the 90s and then never got published. And then, like the rest of, you know, your listeners, I've been trying to earn a living and writing on the side. This book is more commercial, perhaps, than things I've written in the past, and maybe that's why we were able to be successful with it. And it is much more plot-driven than some of the things I've attempted in the past. It's a tough question to answer. You know, I mean, I was very focused on keeping the story moving and exciting and not just, you know, interesting for the backstory. I think sometimes that my prose and my dialogue is stronger than my ability to sculpt a plot, and it definitely took a lot of revisions and rewriting to make all of this flow and to culminate in what I hope, you know, you felt and the readers who, you know, check out the book will agree, was a really exciting and surprising, you know, series of events at the end. And I don't know, you know, I mean, I guess you just do your best as you're writing and then editing, you know, to only keep each sentence and each paragraph that really is important to move the reader to the next one. And it's hard for a writer because each little word and each phrase is a, you know, is like a little gem that you feel like you created. And it's hard for me, at least, and I think this is true for most writers, to cut than it is to add. But that's probably where you really sharpen the work and make it best. So, you know, I tried to do that as much as I could.
I have someone in the chat room that asked a question. I answered it, but I'm curious to know what your answer is. I'm sure he is too. How long should a book be, and can a book be too short?
okay, so
I've asked that question of John Land last week too, whatever, and I got an unusual answer from Alan Topol also, because I reviewed about 4,500 books seriously, and when an author keeps repeating themselves, and the plot drags out within the center of the book, I pray that the book ends.
Right.
It doesn't happen too often, but it does. How long should a book be, and when is it too short?
Yeah, so how long should a book be? I don't feel qualified to answer, and I think it certainly depends on a million different variables.
Yeah.
But like I just said, I think it's more important to it's as a musician. I used to be in a rock band for a long time. We always say that it's the notes that you don't play that matter more than the ones that you do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, the less you need to say to get it across, the better written. Many of my favorite writers are terse and succinct. And that's a perfect segue to answer the other part of your question, which is Hemingway. I'll tell you, when you ask what's too short, well, Hemingway, there's a famous story about him that he wrote an entire story in 6 words. And it goes like this. For sale, baby's shoes, never worn.
That's interesting. That's really interesting. But, okay, we'll move on to the next thing. What other books have you written?
Well, like I said, this is my fourth attempt at a first novel. My first book is called A Metal Sky, and it ended up being self-published back in the 90s, and you can actually find old copies of it on Amazon or on the internet. And I'm really proud of it. I think it's kind of a beautiful story. It's sort of half an expose of the illegal fundraising business for police organizations, and half sort of a coming-of-age, almost Catcher in the Rye-esque story of a young man dealing with the death of a friend. And I'm proud of that book, and I wish that more people had gotten a chance to see it. I wrote two other manuscripts, which were never published, which I'm, you know, not particularly proud of. And then, like I said, The Organ Broker is really my first published novel. I'm proud of it. I'm excited about, you know, the opportunity for, you know, people to, you know, read and enjoy and experience my work. I think it's a commercial book that's really fun and exciting. And also, I'm proud of, you know, some of the messaging and some of the prose and the writing itself. And I just finished my next book.
I was going to ask that question in a minute.
So my forthcoming novel is called The American Party, and it's about the guy who accidentally becomes the leader of the independent political movement that takes down the two-party system in the United States, which you and I were just both complaining about.
Yeah. That's interesting. Question, though. Do you see Jack coming back anytime soon? Are you going to bring him back in another novel? Because he seems to have lots more that he wants to say.
Yeah, so I might. My agent asked me immediately, you know, so what's next for Jack? And I was like,
that's,
you know,
my
Jack
question
who?
Was this, what next? What's next for Jack?
Yeah, yeah. And my answer was Jack who? You know, and he was like, you know, well, come on. You know, I mean, if this book is interesting and if people respond, you know, this is like the perfect material for a series, right, about the Organ Broker. And he goes into the next adventure and what have you. Not of primary interest to me to write a series. That said, I do think Jack is an incredibly colorful, complicated, conflicted, and interesting character. I love writing about him, and I will tell you that I have written the first page of a novel called The Return of the Organ Broker, which I might someday finish, but it's not at the top of the list right now.
Well, one of the questions I asked John Land and Alan Topol the other day, which new authors might want to tackle, is how do you know when you've got that very perfect first paragraph or your beginning of a story? Now, I've got the book in front of me, and if I put my glasses on, I could actually see it, which would really help a lot. And that, as a reviewer, you know, depends on what captures my attention. It says, I've had many last names over the years, but my first name has always been Jack. And that's sort of a unique way to start a book. How did you decide on how to start that book? Then it says, that makes it easier to remember who I am supposed to be. I've been selling organs, mostly kidneys, on the black market. That gets the reader right away. How did you decide on that as the very first beginning, rather than a flashback or a prologue or something like that?
Well, Fran, my compliments to you, because, you know, as someone who said you've reviewed over 4,000 books, it definitely shows.
Yeah, it seems like it never ends.
Well, your questions are awesome. I mean, this is such an important question for a writer, and also for young writers. You know, if you're in school or, you know, aspire to be a writer, I would say it's even more the first sentence than it is the first paragraph. I'm a member of the International Thriller Writers Organization, which is run by some real...
Yeah, I missed you at the Thriller Writers. Introduce you to me, because I was the little blonde girl with the red streaks and blue streaks. I was there.
Oh, that's so funny. So I was actually part of the debut authors panel. It was one morning at that conference, and I was there for one day, and it was fun. And it's run by really nice folks, and they had a contest to write the first, the best first sentence. And I think you're right. Like, it couldn't be more important from, like, a commercial perspective. If you want people to care and to be interested, you have to, obviously, you have to interest them and grab them right away. And first impressions, you never get a second chance to make a first impression. I think that first sentence and that first paragraph, but even more the first sentence, is so critical. The first sentence for this book, the first paragraph for this book, was changed multiple times. The beginning of the novel was probably the place where I changed it and revised it the most, with the help of a freelance editor who I work with, who is fantastic, and then the editor at my publisher, the arcade imprint of Skyhorse Publishing, Julie Gans, who was just a pleasure to work with. I'll give her a quick little shout out. but the beginning of the book was something I struggled with. And I agree with you, you know, at the risk of sounding immodest, that I did land on something that works really well and that it instantly kind of introduces you to this weird world and to this guy in a way that is unique and interesting and also, like, in the very first one or two sentences, captures the essence of, okay, who is this guy and what are we about to talk about? And that's definitely what I try to do. It's funny because I saw... I went to see John Irving, one of my favorite novelists, get interviewed by the New York Times one time, he, by a writer for the Times. He interviewed him in front of a live audience, and John said something about always knowing what the last sentence of his book was going to be and then working backwards.
And
I thought that was amazing. Yeah, I thought that was amazing because that's far beyond my pay grade. I don't know what's going to happen when I first start writing, but I do know how to get started, and, you know, you just do your best.
Well, I know a lot of authors tell me, like Irish Johansson and Sandra Brown, and they say, well, I don't know what's going to happen at the end of the story. The character tells me what I'm going to do. And Jack sort of decided what he was going to do. And it was an interesting ending, and it's 280 pages, and I'm not going to tell you how it ends, people, because you want to read this. You seriously do. It's an important issue that people that need to be brought to light. So maybe, you know, it'll change if enough people read the book and get passionate about it. But there's a word, a definition that I think everybody needs to understand. It's called binding consent. Can you explain that when it comes to organ donating?
Yeah, sure. So what Fran is asking about is a term that relates to kind of the underlying socio-political issue of the organ shortage crisis and, you know, this problem that's, like I said, 21 people are going to die today. You know, during this interview, somebody's going to die in America because they didn't get an organ in time. And what's just so infuriating is that it is actually fixable. I wrote an article for Salon.com, which you can find on my website, theorganbroker.com, where I made some suggestions for maybe some of the ways that we could address and fix the problem. That was published last year. But the problem with binding consent is that, you know, in a famous Gallup poll conducted 10 years ago, 95% of Americans said they approve of organ donation. But the way that we sign them up, it's like from the dark ages. You know, it's from when this stuff first became possible in the 80s. The only way that they could think of to get people to register was at the Department of Motor Vehicles. I mean, it's kind of crazy. You know, it's
yeah,
not a well-run...
Yeah, they have that on your motor vehicles when you renew your license. They do ask you if you want to be an organ donor.
Right. But it's not
they
the best-run... It's not the best-run organization, and it's also not a national organization. Each state is completely separate, right? So 95% of Americans approve of organ donation, but only 45% bother to actually register at the DMV. Now, that's something that we could fix. Frankly, we could fix it in one quick swoop of a pen because about 20 countries in Europe have now gone to what is called presumed consent. And that means
that the other question. That was the other question,
So I'll answer them in reverse order. Presumed consent means that instead of having to register to be a donor, everybody is presumed to be a donor until they register to opt out. Yeah. And the funny thing is, while a lot of people, you know, like to talk and say they might not want to be an organ donor, if they had to fill out a one-page form, nobody bothers to. You know, in Europe, the average opt-out rate is 3%. So if we had presumed consent, the percentage of registration could go from 45 to more like 95 overnight. And then The other problem, and this was your original question, is binding consent. Even with 45% of Americans registered to be organ donors, we often get situations. Most organs are sourced from people who end up brain dead in a hospital. And there's about 15,000. Yeah, there's about 15,000 Americans each year that, mostly in car accidents or some other way, a stroke, end up brain dead in a hospital where there's zero brain function, but their other vital organs are still functioning. There is 0% chance of recovery from brain death. It cannot happen. So those people can be potential organ donors. But what happens is they ask the families for consent, whether or not the patient has already registered. And I think that this is crazy. And my position on this is controversial. Not everybody agrees with me, but I'll explain to you why I see it that way. The problem lies in that, remember, this is someone, the patient, who was, it's not like they had cancer and they were dying for years. This is someone who an hour ago was perfectly fine, and now, an hour later, their wife, child, friend rushes to the hospital to find out that a doctor tells them your dad or your sister, who was fine an hour ago, is now brain dead. She's never going to recover, and we want to cut out her kidneys and give them to somebody else. And some people in that moment of, you know, incredible crisis are able to say, okay, look, you know, if there's zero chance of recovery and it could save someone else's life, okay, let's do that. But a lot of people are so freaked out and so upset that they can't process this, and they decline, you know. And so my argument is, when I die, I have twin sons who turned 11 last week. When I die, is someone from the hospital going to come out and say to my sons, okay, so your dad had a will, he left you some money, he said that you don't get it till you're 25. Do you want us to honor the will, or should we just, like, cut you a check now? Right? Obviously, that sounds crazy.
I get it.
And we would never do that. And yet, in America today, if I say, I want to be an organ donor, and if something happens to me, I want my organs to go save someone else, as I, you know, Stu, have done, when I end up brain dead in a hospital, instead of honoring my wishes, they're going to ask my children at the very, very worst time. And my question is, why is it in America that I can determine the disposition of my money after I die, but not my own body? That makes no sense.
Well, what about, I know what you're saying, because when my sister died 5 years ago, I was her health proxy, and I knew what she wanted. And when I got to the hospital, my brother-in-law said he couldn't find it. And he wanted to pull the plug on her right away, and I guess my mouth is larger than his, and I won for quite some time. So when people don't want to become organ donors or don't agree because they, you know, will go against what the family member might have wanted, do they think that it's because they feel the body is being desecrated when it's, you know, being taken apart, or the organs are taken apart? Is that how they feel? Or is there a religious reason why they might not want to do that?
Well, there's a variety of reasons. So as for the religious aspect, most major religions support organ donation. And if you think about it, you know, America is mostly a Christian country. I mean, what would Jesus do? You know, if you had the opportunity to be giving and to save the life of another, isn't that very much in the spirit of Christ, if you will? Pope John Paul II even spoke to this issue when he was the Pope and said that the Catholic Church strongly supports organ donation. Most major religions do. I think that there are people who are confused, who use religious justification to argue against organ donation, but it isn't really logical in most cases, and most major religions support it. There are fundamental sects of Judaism where anything that desecrates the body, even getting a tattoo, is kind of prohibited. And unfortunately, that's one of the reasons that Israel is one of the biggest net importers of organs, but they don't make organ donations, and that country gets criticism for that I think is unfair, because it's kind of grounded in a philosophical religious belief. But either way,
I do know that religion, if you have a tattoo, you can't basically, I don't know if they honor it, be buried in a Orthodox or Jewish cemetery.
No, that's absolutely true. You can't be buried.
I was born
Jewish. I'm not religious, but I was born Jewish, and I do have tattoos. And there's no question you can't be buried in a Orthodox or conservative cemetery.
Yeah, I know. And I've got a lot of relatives that whatever. And I also know that they're intermarried, and that's not supposed to be there either. But there are ways to do everything. But before I forget, I better announce my show for next week, because otherwise I'm going to forget. No, I'm not.
Okay.
Next week I have a very interesting show, Homeport Journals. The author is A.C. Birch, and it's about two sisters that haven't spoken to each other for 60 years, and we have two guys that fall in love, and they bring them together. The story is fantastic. The week after, we've got New York Times bestselling author that was at the Thriller Fest, Simon Chavez, Thin Black Line. The book is absolutely amazing. And that same week, Dr. Kenneth Ween, a mental health specialist, Time to Try the Soul of Man. And the creator of classic TV, Herbie Pilato, asked me, I'm so honored, to create a special show on October 29th to commemorate 50 years of Bewitched, and to do a special show in memory of Elizabeth Montgomery and the cast of Bewitched. I don't know how come I got chosen to do this, but I am excited. So, before we end, how does someone become an organ donor?
Yeah, really easy. Just go to www.donatelife.net, and when you get there, you'll select the state that you live in. You can literally sign up in 2 minutes. Stories
and myths. I'm
going
to put that on my thing.
Yeah, stories and myths about, you're not going to get as good at medical care if you're an organ donor. Absolute nonsense. Never happens. Most likely, your status as an organ donor will never come up. But if, in fact, you were one day tragically one of the very, very few people that end up in an accident, end up brain dead in a hospital, if you're going to die anyway, for me at least, the choice was easy. The idea that, spare parts in my body could be used to save 5 or 6 or 8 other people's lives, I would definitely want to do that. And I think you have to think about, if you or someone that you love ended up needing a kidney or a liver or an organ, and there weren't enough organ donors, how might that make you feel or affect you when there are people who end up brain dead and then their families are burying those bodies without, gifting the organs, and they're literally throwing out, thousands of organs every year that could have saved other people's lives. Let's not be a part of that. Let's be a part of the solution. So please do register. And I also ask your listeners to please check out my book. It's interesting.
Please check out the book. You've got to read it. It's fantastic.
Yeah. All these issues are discussed, but also it's just a really cool, exciting story. And it's called The Organ Broker. Again, theorganbroker.com. The ebook is on sale on Amazon. It's also available in Audible form. And Amazon hired a cool, weird actor to kind of do all the voices, and it's a lot of fun.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I have one last question. If
sure.
Jack stood in front of you right now, what would he say? Would he do it over again, or would he change the course and change his decision?
I'm not following exactly what you're asking.
In other words,
what
if
would
the
I...
main character of your book, Jack, was standing in front of you, but he's a real person, would
right.
he do it all over again? Or would he change his course of action and his decisions? Do you think he would have done his organ broker, or would he and live his life the way he did, or would he change his
mind?
Oh,
I see. Yeah, I think the whole point of the book is that Jack is like all of us. He's not good or bad. He's somewhere in between. And every one of us is kind of somewhere on that spectrum between perfectly good and perfectly bad. Jack lived most of his life really close to the bad side of the spectrum. But in his heart and fundamentally, he, like most of us, I think, he wanted to do good. I think if I met Jack in real life, and or you did, and we asked mm-hmm. him that question, he would definitely make different decisions and would have never gone down that road.
But he sort of had to, because he was needed to pay for other things and for college. And, of course, there's better ways to pay for college, as I know from my three nephews that started college, we hope. But you never really know. So tell everybody what's next for you and how they can learn more about you.
Yeah, well, like I said, my new book is out with publishers right now. It's called The American Party. It's about the independent political movement in America. I hope that it'll be published next year. The Organ Broker was only released a couple of months ago. It's available mm-hmm. on Amazon and also at theorganbroker.com, where you can learn a little bit about me and about these issues. I had an article published in Everyday Health a couple of months ago that explained some of the things that we could do to fix this. And I definitely urge your listeners to please check out my novel and also to register to be an organ donor.
Well, I have a question. I'm going to put you right on the spot, before I close.
Do it.
I am the editor, people, of MJ Magazine in memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce, who told me 5 years ago that I weighed 190 pounds. I only weigh 106 now. Are you going to become a couch potato, or are you going to do something? It's her fault that I've been reviewing books and did radio and everything. So I was very proud to create this magazine for authors, writers, readers, young writers. MJ Magazine is going to come out with 7th edition. I can't believe I did 6 already. At the end of this month, beginning of next, and I would love to, for you to write an article about organ donations and this issue for the magazine. That would be really great. In the Speak Out section of my magazine that I'm starting. And if anybody out there writes poems from the heart, I want to do a special MJ Magazine Poems from the Heart poetry edition, which I hope to come out around the same time. So my email address is gabina49@gmail.com. That's what my sister used to call me. gabina49@gmail.com, and I would love for you to write an article about organ donating for the magazine.
Fran, you are quite the salesperson. Who could possibly say no to that while in a live interview? But I have to tell you that I have promised the folks I've met along the way. I've interviewed, 10 or 20 organ transplant recipients, and I work with Donate Life America and some other great organizations to try to, make a difference on this thing that I just kind of learned about accidentally. I'm very committed to trying to, help educate people about this stuff, and I would be honored, to submit a little article for you. So I'll drop you an email when we get offline, and I'd be happy to participate.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I want to thank everybody that's listening. My show goes on next Thursday at 10, like I said, Homeport Journals with A.C. Birch. Monday, I never do Mondays, but now that I have my own network, Monday, September 21st, Thin Black Line with Simon Gervais. I'm so excited. November 10th, I've got Alan Jacobson that was also at the Thriller Fest, The Lost Codex. And then I was really, really surprised when Mike Bond asked for an interview for Killing Maine in May. And Brian Freeman, who's a mystery thriller writer, wrote West 57th, It's a Romance, funny Candice Brugel kind of novel by a young girl that takes over a publishing company. And there's like about 47 more books that are staring at Fran and saying, please read me. But we will get to them one. Yeah, I know. And I do hope I get your new book before it comes out so I can, give you some blurbs or whatever you need for the back cover or just
absolutely
to review it before it comes out. I'm excited. So thank you so very much, and thanks, everyone, for listening, and have a great day. And Fran, unfortunately, is off to the dentist, which is no fun, but that's a whole other story.
Fran,
have a great
so
day.
Much.
You're very
okay,
welcome.
Thanks for having
bye.
Me.